So what we've been talking about in the Dharma life, well, in a way, in any life, fully lived life, is that you need to have both an activity and receptivity. You need to make an effort, a willed effort, if you like, and also you need to be receptive and maybe learn how to be receptive. Often I think we sort of privilege the activity because we kind of feel, well, that will get things done, you know, that's what will move us on in life. And so we need to remind ourselves, even educate ourselves, of the importance of receptivity. So this whole year at the LBC we're dedicating to this, to this quality of dharmic receptivity. And whenever I think of activity and receptivity, I always think of the story from the Bible of Martha and Mary. Do people know it? Some people might know it. Anyway, I'll tell you, I hope I remembered it properly. If I haven't, we'll just take it as a little story I'm telling you. It's a story that's often quoted to me, actually, this story, and you might guess why when I tell you. So the story is there's two sisters, and one's called Martha and one's called Mary. And Jesus has come to their house to visit them and to give a teaching. And as he's teaching, Mary is just sitting listening. Mary's just sitting listening to Jesus' teaching. Martha, meanwhile, is like making the dinner, the equivalent of whatever doing the hoovering would be, getting the house all clean, and feeling that what she's doing is very, very important. And also, more importantly, is getting annoyed with Mary for just sitting there, listening to the teaching of Jesus, and saying, and she tells her off and says, look, you know, there's work to be done here. You can't just sit there all day, like, just listening. And but Jesus says something to the effect of, no, Mary's the one who's got it right. Sitting listening here. So for some strange reason, this story is often quoted to me. probably because I have the tendency to be rushing around, sort of doing things. So I think, in a way, I think what Jesus in this case is drawing out is, well, yes, we think all this doing the hoovering and everything is very important, but this receptivity, this listening to the teaching is, he's putting far more value on that. So I'm going to come back to that story because I think that story is good up to a point, but I think only up to a point, which I'll come back to. But it's because I just want to say a little bit more about willed effort, because in a way, well, I suppose I've always sympathised a bit with Martha as well, and kind of thought, well, you know, you do need to do things as well. So in the Dharma life, and you even need to do things for your spiritual life. But maybe I found very helpful a lecture that I've been listening to, given by Subhuti. He gave it at Padmaloka, you can get it on Free Buddhist Audio. It was a whole series on the five great stages of the path, receptivity being one. So I would recommend you listen to that. You can easily get it on Free Buddhist Audio. And I'm going to be taking what I'm saying tonight a lot from that lecture, and also from a lecture in this book by Bhante Sankarachita. The book's called Wisdom Beyond Words, and the lecture is called The Greater Mandala. It's one of his kind of lectures that has become a bit of a sort of key lecture. So it's not that willed effort isn't important at all. We do need to do things in life, but also in our spiritual life, we need to make an effort to get here, for example. We've got to actually get ourselves here, etc. But I think the important thing to realise is that the effort we're making is that we're setting up the conditions for something to emerge. So in a sense, it's not that we, especially in our Dharma lives, are making something happen, but we're setting up the conditions for something to happen. I was at my poetry class early today, and we're doing sort of formal verse, so we're doing all about rhyme and metre and so on. And our tutor was saying, when you come to do rhyme, you can't just take a word and go like basket, right? What rhymes with basket? Casket, you know, basket, you know. You can't just kind of go like that. She says, what you've got to do, now this is very interesting, she says, concentrate on the truth, and then you'll find, as if by magic, the right rhyme will appear. Yeah? And I thought, so this is what I'm trying to say when I'm saying about you don't make something happen. You've got to remember the effort we make is setting up the conditions, and then something will happen. Yeah, a bit like on the poetry, the effort, you've got to get yourself in the right frame of mind to even, well, know what the truth is, connect with it, and then as if by magic something will happen. I mean, and this is, I imagine you've experienced this. I think especially on retreat, you can notice that. You know, if you go on retreat, for those who've been, and you've got a real problem, and the temptation is, you want to go over and over in your mind, what am I going to say in this email or letter? And you think you can work it out, but then if you can just sort of trust somehow that if you just meditate, and the right answer often appears. I had it myself actually with a letter the other day. I had a difficult letter to write to someone, and I was going over and over. I was going, right, I better say this. And this letter was getting longer and longer in my mind. And I was going for a walk. I was walking down the canal, and I was trying, because we'd been doing this dharmic receptivity, I was going, no, just come back, feel your feet on the ground. Stop going round and round. And then I think, oh my gosh, I'm going round and round again. Just come back. Few minutes, round and round again, just come back. And I did that for ages. I walked along the canal and I practiced it in meditation and the metta bhavana for about 2 weeks. And then one day, at the end of a metta bhavana, which had actually felt quite distracted, I suddenly knew what to write. And it was about four sentences, you know, it was kind of reduced from this big, long, complicated. And I thought, no, that's it. And I knew it was right. I didn't, you know, I was thinking, when I come to write the letter, I better run it past somebody to make sure it's okay. But I thought, no, I don't need to run it past anyone. I know this is the right letter. And it was a very positive response and so on. And I'm sure that you know the kind of, the people sort of know the kind of thing I'm talking about. That if you set up the condition, you do have to make some effort, but the effort in my case was to come back to my physical experience, come back to doing the metta bhavana the proper way, or at least the attempt to that, rather than going round and round, and then the answer comes. Yeah, is that sort of making sense so far? So and I think the retreat is a particularly good example of when you come back, you see things with new perspective often, and like you become different. So life becomes different because you are different. Yeah? And what Subhuti says in his lecture that I got excited about was, he says, if you keep practicing that and trusting that, he said that eventually a new faculty will start to take over. And he says, instead of willing, you'll find yourself responding. So the new faculty he's calling responsiveness. Yeah? And why I got excited by it is it solves this Martha and Mary thing that had always troubled me a bit. It sort of solves the problem of willfulness, where the problem of willfulness being that one is so concerned not to make an effort in the wrong way that you end up ricocheting between making an effort in the wrong way, not making any effort at all. So sort of rushing around doing all the work that needs done and then just sort of not doing anything. So it's sort of, you've no longer got this polarisation. If you think of responsiveness and our new faculty emerging, you've not got that ricocheting between, well, what I'm calling this Martha mode and this Mary mode. Or people often talk about the being and doing mode. That's always troubled me a bit as well, you know, because it feels like there's this mode and then there's that mode. And then we end up talking about balancing, you know, you've got to balance this being and doing. I've never sat easy with that. You know, I kind of thought, well, you know, it's not really, when we think of the Buddha, we don't think, oh yeah, he had a really good work-life balance. It's not kind of the Buddha. that's not what I want to strive to. I don't want to strive towards having a good balance, you know. I want, this Buddha's got something much more than that. And I think this responsiveness is the key, you know, I think it became the key for that. And this, you know, goes right back to this this lecture of Bhante's that was talking about. You know, I don't know when he gave it, probably ages ago. You know, whenever you think you've thought something new, you know, Bhante's almost thought of it about 20 years before. And this is the case with this. So I'll just tell you what he says about how a bodhisattva, or you could say a Buddha, you know, a bodhisattva, you know, being who's kind of dedicated for the welfare of all, he says that. So when he's saying on one hand the Buddha or the Bodhisattva wouldn't be sort of willful in the narrow way, but he says at the same time, he says, I'm not talking about some lotus-eating, daydreaming, navel-gazing ideal either. So he says the Bodhisattva or the Buddha is the greatest worker of all. Now, they're constantly responding to the objective needs of the situation, but at the same time he or she operates within what he calls the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation. So a mandala is a kind of image of wholeness. Yeah, it's if you were to sort of give a visual impression of a mandala, it would be a circle. It would be a sort of something like a lotus. You know, something open, something like a sort of beautiful pattern, but with a sense of, well, a circle that could ever expand, yeah? So this mandala of aesthetic appreciation. So, and then, so this is the bit I really like. He says, it's not even as though this sphere or this mandala within which the Bodhisattva operates is a sphere of practical activity that's somehow separate from this greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation. He says that the Buddha or the Bodhisattva, it's not that they absent themselves from this greater mandala when they carry on their practical activities. He says the greater mandala, the something of responsiveness, of this aesthetic quality, interpenetrates that limited sphere, you know, when we're getting everything done. So the practical activities are an expression of the greater mandala. So, in other words, he's saying that the Buddha or the Bodhisattva transcends these two unsatisfactory extremes. So, on the one hand, you can be so immersed, or I can be so immersed in practical activities that you completely identify with them, get really harassed, get really worried, and sort of lose sight of the much bigger perspective, which he's calling aesthetic appreciation. On the other hand, you could lose yourself in a sort of spaced out, he says, a vaguely positive state of mind where you just can't do anything, yeah? You're just sort of wandering around. But he says the ideal is the middle way, and by, it's a very interesting notion, this middle way. I'm sure I've said it this class before, because the middle way in Buddhism isn't just a sort of halfway house. It isn't like, well, sometimes I'm really busy and then when it all gets too much, I go and kind of get a bit, I go and blob out. Yeah, it's not like a halfway. It's something that's over and above these two. Yes, it's something completely above that. So he says the ideal is the middle way. So he says we need to carry on the cycle of practical activities that, to which we're not attached and which aren't harassing us and that we're not worrying about, within the much bigger circle of this greater mandala. And this greater mandala being, well, Bhante's calling it the mandala of aesthetic appreciation, the mandala of just much, much bigger perspective. And Subhuti's calling it, I think, the same thing, a mode of being that's responsive, a mode of being that is, it's a new, it's more and more a new faculty that's taking over. This instead of sort of trying to drive yourself and will yourself into being a sort of person, but then sort of ricocheting into, because that's unsustainable, then ricocheting into a more of a sort of blobbing out, spacing out, sort of vaguely thinking I'll try and balance this out somehow here. So I really like this this responsiveness. So, and it's something that we can become more and more. So we can become somebody with more and more of a capacity of for responding to value. So, and value can encompass well beauty, such as the beauty of nature, the qualities of a friend, just that when you just take delight in a friend's qualities. The truth itself, you know, many of us, that when we first hear the Dharma, we just somehow know it's true. We might not even be able to quite say what we even mean by that, but we just kind of think, God, it just feels true. Actually, somebody wrote me a letter earlier in the week, and she said that very same thing. She said she was talking about her Mitra study group, which is a Dharma study group for people who are Mitras, and she said it's the highlight of my week. Every week I go, and I know it's true, but if you to ask me later, what exactly did you say about which, she might not be able to repeat exactly what was said, but there's just this, it's more of a sense of the truth of it. So that's responding to value. You know, that response we might have to a noble action that you might witness in someone or read in the papers or so on, or to art. So we become someone with a capacity for responding to value. And then Subhuti, he's got a very interesting list, which I've written up here, so I don't know if Adrabandha would just flip this, which I've been sort of pondering myself. And in a way, you could spend a whole evening just on this list, I think, because he gives a quality, he sort of describes responsiveness in the negative. I quite like things being described in the negative, because it sort of stops you thinking that you know what it is. And I think that's valuable in itself. That's why I call my book Not About Being Good, in a way, because I wanted to, you know, as soon as you say something is something, you think you've got it pinned down. Whereas when you say what it's not, it makes you think. And I've certainly thought about this list, and not exhaustively. So Bhutti says this new faculty of responsiveness, he says it's not thought, although it is intelligent. Yeah? So that's the first not. He says it's not feeling in the sense of mere emotion, although it is richly felt. That's quite interesting, isn't it? It's not feeling, but yet it is richly felt. So you've got a kind of something to ponder, I think, there. Well, here's another good one. He says it's not active, though it is freely moving. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? It's not active, yet it is freely moving. I thought maybe sort of suddenly thought something like a river. You know, you see a river moving, but you wouldn't ever really say that river's really active. I suppose you might. I don't know. Anyway, it's interesting, isn't it? You might say, yeah, something that's freely moving. Or you wouldn't say, I don't know, the movement of the planets, of the spheres around the sun. They're active, but, you know, they're freely moving, but you wouldn't say, oh yeah, they're kind of out being active. You wouldn't kind of say, the moon's very active tonight. So, you know, but at the same time, there's movement. And it's not passive, though it's open and receptive. So, like, straight away, I think that leads you into thinking, what is this quality of responsiveness? It's not a thought, not feeling in the sort of narrow sense, not active and not passive. and yet we probably all have had a taste of it. We probably have all had a taste of just that pure response. And it probably starts, or one way it can start is, well, when we just respond to beauty in any of these ways, when we're drawn by something. I think that it's definitely got this quality of sort of like a magnetic thing we feel we're drawn towards, which, well, like the way my Trevanda said when he saw that t-shirt, you know, suddenly it goes in another way and you sort of see it in a new way. And I don't know, I got quite a visual sense of you're captivated by it. And I could imagine you standing in front of it, just drawn by it. And what's the bit he says, and I more and more think this must be true, and I more and more think, I think this is what Bantu's been trying to say to us all along, and I have, I was going to say haven't fully understood. I'm sure I've still got lots more to go in understanding. But that this responsiveness, which starts with a responsiveness to beauty, is on a continuum with what we call faith in Buddhism, that there's no, in a way, it's not a separate thing from that, that faith's a kind of, for want of a better word, higher level of that, because the response to beauty, if we're then drawn to the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, if they become more and more our ideal of what beauty is, then this responsiveness to beauty will become what we call shraddha, or faith, because we'll see more and more that they're the real beauty. Well, in a sense, that's why they're jewels, in a sense, they're presented as something beautiful, so we'll more and more feel that beauty lies in, well, the Buddha, lies in the Dharma, and lies in the Sangha, and, well, in a sense, the attempt to create Sangha. That's what, and then responsiveness becomes shraddha, or faith. And then eventually, Subhuti says, and again, I think this must be true, that then it will fulfil itself in insight itself, and eventually in enlightenment itself, that it's the same thing. It's not essentially different, although there'll be, you know, it has to fulfil itself more and more. It sort of starts off and then grows and grows and grows, and it's drawn out more and more and more. And at that stage, when it fulfils itself in insight itself, well, then it becomes what you are. So this thing, you've started off feeling as a sort of glimmers of more and more response, and eventually you just are responsiveness. That's who you are. You become responsiveness itself. The value is all you're interested in, and also you see it wherever it is. You see it more and more. Whatever it is, you're kind of drawn as if by a magnet to it. And this sort of... this seeing or whatever it is, and this is really important, it's certainly important to me, it's not a sort of cold thing. When you talk about seeing value, whatever it is, it's not a sort of detached looking at value. It's a sort of alive, even sort of quivering sort of thing. It's like the life in you is like quivering with a response to what's true in the universe. And again, going back to this seminal lecture of Bhante's, A Greater Mandala, he starts the lecture saying something that I really, really like. He says, the enlightenment of the Buddha was not a cold, detached knowledge. He saw with warmth, he saw with feeling, and what is more, he saw everything as being shubha, which means beautiful. And he says, the Buddha saw everything as pure beauty because he saw everything with compassion. And it helped me to understand it when he says, just as conversely, when you hate somebody, they appear ugly. Which is really true, though, isn't it? When you're in that state of hatred, everything and everybody feels ugly. So in a way, sometimes it's easier to understand the negative, isn't it? But the Buddha would see everything as shubha, beautiful, because he's seen with compassion, he's seen with metta. So he says the Buddha's wisdom in its fullest sense includes metta, and that in a sense you could even say that metta is prana. Now he's saying metta, but in a way I think you could just as well say responsiveness, because in a sense, what is metta if it's not responsiveness? I think, like, to me, they become more and more interchangeable. Like, the quality of metta is the quality of, well, the capacity for just responding positively to life and to whatever life throws at you and whoever life throws to you, and just kind of whatever state they're in. A Buddha would always have a metaphor response. That means a Buddha would always have a sort of responsive response. Yeah, so I think you could just as well say that the Buddha's wisdom in its fullest sense includes this responsiveness. Responsiveness is metta. Metta is responsiveness. That's the kind of seeing that we're talking about. And you know, I'm kind of talking about it in its highest form with the Buddha or Bodhisattva. And I want to say that we probably all again had glimpses, and maybe even more than that in our more ordinary experience. So I think with the Dharma, you're constantly going to the highs, but then kind of think, well, where can I find an echo of that? I was telling my Trey Bando about this. We were talking about what to do in the class, and I was saying, oh, I know what I'm going to do on my evening. I'm going to get everybody drawing. I said, I'm going to bring in like lots of oranges, and everybody's got to draw an orange. My Trey Bando is going, no. That would be great. People are really having an experience of what I'm talking about. He's going, no. But what was on my mind when I was, why I wanted to do this was an experience I had myself of not actually drawing an orange, but drawing a person. So I've never really done any drawing in my life. And one day it was a little weekend retreat for order members, and the person leading the retreat was herself an artist. And she was very, very keen on the relationship between art and meditation. So what she got us to do was she got one of the order members to sit there, and we had to look at this person and draw her. It was so lovely. You know, it was such a lovely experience to do that. As it happened, the person who was being drawn was someone that I know very well. Her name's Shraddha Pushpa. Some of you might know she's, I think, probably our oldest order member around here. She must be nearly 80. Quite frail in her being, and physically, but not at all in her either intellect or kind of just well everything. You know, she's very, very vigorous here, and she still leads one of our classes here during the day. And not only that, I'd happened to live with her in a community for a number of years, so I knew the story of her life. So I knew, for example, that she was on the very last train out of Austria in the war before, like literally the last train and then last boat before that was no more out, yeah? And that was when she was a little girl. And then she arrived in London, and she was the only child. All the other children had been evacuated. But then, so she's in a strange position of being the only, one of the few children in London, and, you know, and going down into the underground for the, you know, when the bombs were going over. So, you know, I knew all this about her. And there she was, like, sitting, like, elderly. And, you know, her posture quite kind of old, you know, kind of folded up in a way, concertina. And I just something about taking a pencil and following that line of her, and maybe because I knew her, I did think, how could you do this without feeling meta? You can't do this without feeling meta, actually. It was such a lovely thing, actually, just when you're looking at someone like that. So Maitreya Vanda said it was all right for me just to tell you about that, rather than actually try and get you all trying. And again, you might, you know, whether you might have tried to draw or, you know, probably everybody's tried something that's maybe given them a little taste of that, maybe just even trying to describe somebody to a friend or photograph them or draw them or write about them or so. You kind of, it tunes you into them, and in a way, that seems to, if you... that seems to just bring about this feeling of metta. And I think that's a glimpse of what Bantry's talking about, what the Buddha would see, that, yeah, it's not a cold, attached knowledge. You know, you're not, when I was drawing Shraddha Pushpa, I wasn't kind of trying to, you know, it's more about looking, you know, and seeing, and like loving, really, and knowing the story. I think that's what Bantry's trying to get, and that's the way the Buddha would see everything, you know, because he just sees us all as all in the same boat, you know. He just sees us all as, oh goodness, there they are, you know. They want to be happy, but oh God, they're going and doing that very thing that makes them unhappy, and there would be a tenderness to that. There'd be the wisdom of seeing, you know, seeing that trying to get happiness out of things that can't give you happiness is futile. But there'd be the love of, oh, you know, what a pity, you know, what a pity, there'd be that. And that's what we would feel as compassion. So there's love there. And what we're doing is we're, one way of putting it, and this is the way that Banti's putting it, is that we're trying to see beyond the utilitarian. When we look at whatever we look at, we're trying to see beyond the utilitarian. So he says, again in this lecture, he says, if what we see is the utilitarian value of something, we're relating to it from a need. And then that becomes a desire, and that in turn becomes a craving for the object, because we think it will fulfill that desire. So for example, we'll see a tree, kind of classic example, we'll see it not as existing in its own right for its own sake, but something to fulfill our own need. So we're not so used to cutting down trees for firewood, but you know, we might say, oh yeah, I could cut that down, it could be firewood. We can probably, you know, think of equipment, we can look at so many things, well, and people, sadly, and kind of not really see them, but in sort of subtle or not so subtle ways think, well, how can they give me the thing that I want? If we were a Buddha, we wouldn't have desires to be fulfilled. We wouldn't, in a sense, we'd be empty of that desire to use things for a particular purpose. So all that would be left would be this aesthetic appreciation. So in a way, there's an emptiness of desire, but there's a fullness, because that's all there'd be. We'd just enjoy things for their own sake. There'd be none of this kind of trying to make them fit in, which is kind of doomed to failure anyway. Banti gives the little bit from the poem of a little bit of the Four Quartets, just a few lines by T.S. Eliot. He says it's like that how a Buddha would experience the world would be like music heard so deeply that it is not heard at all, but you are the music while the music lasts. And he's saying that because he says if you were a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, you'd enjoy the whole world as much as you'd enjoy a work of art or an artistic performance. Yeah? It would be like music heard so deeply that it is not heard at all, but you are the music while the music lasts. So just to say a little bit more of what Banti says. So the Buddha Bodhisattva has a response to the world that's aesthetic and appreciative rather than utilitarian. And he says, I mean, he does kind of concede, Banti, that, you know, to sort of be alive in the world, we do have to engage in a certain amount of practical activity. So there is a bit of sympathy with poor Martha there. Mm-hmm. But you have to think about things and understand how the world works. So we do have to do that. But if you're a Buddha, then all that takes place within an overall context of aesthetic appreciation. And what he says is, he says we usually, and I can really relate to this, think of aesthetic appreciation, kind of inverted commas, almost like this little separate part of life within our kind of proper real life that's kind of this utilitarian. So we've got our life and we think, okay, on Sunday I'll go to an art gallery. You know, we've got this little corner that's the aesthetic appreciation. Banti says it's got to be the other way around. So it's like I think that mandala's quite a good image because it's this big circle. So you've got this bigger circle that's the aesthetic appreciation. That's our overall response of life. And the practical things happen as a little bit within that. So instead of kind of thinking that the aesthetic approach to life is something we do, you know, on a Sunday afternoon or whenever it is, it's like it's more trying to think more and more of ourselves, or living more within this, what he's calling this greater mandala, and all the practical, all the mundane affairs happen within that. And so what he's arguing is that the real values are aesthetic, not utilitarian. So that's the kind of gist of it. So that's what Bhatti's saying, and Subhuti's saying something similar, more in the active. He's saying we've got to, the real way of being is responsive, like, rather than willful, yeah, rather than a willed effort. What replaces that willed effort is responsiveness. And again, we probably, in some ways, I kind of look at this and I think, oh God, it seems like an impossible ideal, you know, and in a way, it's probably a far off ideal, well, for me anyway. But I think a helpful way to look at it on a more kind of ordinary level is just simply that, to look at, well, where do we do things that are both useful and enjoyable at the same time? I mean, in a way, that's a more simple way to say it. That the Buddha or Bodhisattva does useful things, but that he or she is enjoying them. So they're not really feeling like work. Well, they're feeling more like play than work. Yeah, and it's often said of the Buddha that the Buddha plays rather than works. I remember I used to not be very enamoured of that notion. And the word for play is lila. Some of you know lilamani from the class here, regulars to the class. I remember before I was ordained, you know, you know you're going to get this new name when you're doing it. I thought, oh, I hope it's not lila. I won't be able to bear it. I couldn't really get to grips with this notion of play because I thought, well, I don't know, it just sounded a bit frivolous or something to me, and not part of the sort of the real work to be done. But I've come to see it more. I've come to see it more. It has not been frivolous at all, actually. I'm not being, in a funny way, being, you can't really say play serious, but, well, maybe I'll just give an example. I'll give an example where I most strongly feel that in my kind of everyday life, I have a sense where I'm doing something that somebody else would call useful, but to me, I'm feeling that it's completely enjoyable. And what it is, and it's something I have the privilege of doing quite often, so as you might know, I'm the Mitra convener here at the Centre for Women. So when a woman wants to be a Mitra, they usually write to me first and then they come and talk to me. And in 6 years of doing this, like unfailingly, that conversation has been one of the most, I mean, to say enjoyable is to not even fully saying it. You know, just, it does feel like a privilege that there I am, often sitting in my office or sitting in the larder next door, going for a walk, like talking with someone we might not really have met that much up until this point, but there we are having a really immediately in-depth conversation about value. I just feels like, how did I get to be so lucky to have this as my job, you know? And what often strikes me is at the end of the conversation, what the mitra-to-be will often say, they'll often say thank you, and they'll often say, oh, thanks for giving me the time. And I always feel, but really, you know, I really, really don't feel like I've given anything. You know, this has been such a pleasure. There's no sense of me thinking, you know, I gave you this time, you know. It doesn't feel like that at all. It feels like, oh, I've just had this really positive hour, you know. But also it seems to, well, usually meant something to the other person as well. So I think that to me seems to sort of illustrate this mode of being where you're doing something that, you know, somebody else might see as they're being given to, but you yourself, you don't feel like you've done anything apart from done the most natural thing in the world, or it's even been a privilege to do it. And again, I'm sure you've all had something of that experience. You know, I'm sure that there's, in a way, I'm saying that you've all had something. Sometimes it's hard to know you've had it because it won't feel like you've done anything, actually. I remember saying in this class once something like that. I asked people, well, can you think of that experience you've had yourself? And people could think of it, but then one man, he said, no, I've never had it. He says, oh God, I feel terrible. I've never had that experience when I've given in this way that it doesn't feel like anything. And I said, but look, every Wednesday night you come to this class and help and you make the tea and you welcome people on the door. And he said, oh, but that doesn't count. And I said, oh, but that's it. You see, that it's the things we think don't count. That's it, because it won't count to us, because we aren't counting. We aren't thinking, oh, well, there's a good thing I've done. You know, that's a few brownie points for me. I've been good. And we actually won't feel like we've done anything. Actually, now I've just realised another understanding of this Martha and Mary thing. You see, yeah, that's where Martha's gone wrong, because she's not just enjoying, like, doing that hoovering and making the dinner. She's counting it. That's where it goes wrong. She's kind of going, well, you know, all very well for you to sit listening to Jesus, but like, I'm doing this. So if she was just doing it, you see, what Martha's got to do is be equally happy with both. She's got to go, oh, no, isn't that great Mary's here in the teaching? And isn't it great I'm doing the hoovering? Brilliant, we're both happy. So if she was that, then Jesus would have told her off. You see, that's it. So when we find ourselves, so that's the difference. That's the difference. Good, I've understood that a bit better myself. So that's what we mean by, I think, so that's the sort of play of the Buddha. Yeah, when it's not counting, you're not counting it as work. The Buddha wouldn't be thinking, oh yeah, what a good Buddha I've been today, you know. The Buddha's just sort of being, yeah. And Bhante says, well, that's the difference. He says the difference between work and play, and this lila play, is that play isn't necessary. Yeah, so it's not harnessed to a goal, and it doesn't serve a purpose. And well, that's what. I should say a little bit first. I was going to jump onto the art. So I just want to go back to. Well, this no. Yeah, we're talking about that. That's what the Buddha would be. So the Buddha would just see the world as beauty. Would just experience life as play and see beauty everywhere. That's what we're aiming at, and that's why I'm kind of arguing that. When we, this kind of notion of being, doing, you know, work-life balance, isn't what the aim of our Dharma practice is trying to get us to do. It's trying to get us into this mode of responsiveness and seeing beauty everywhere. But, and it might be that we have to start off with trying to create a bit of balance, if I allow myself to use that word. So, you know, in the end, a Buddha, in a sense, wouldn't need to go on retreat. But we probably do, you know, so just to say that we can't catapult ourselves to there. But I think it's important to know where we're going. So we're ultimately trying to transcend this notion of balance. But we might need to bring in a bit of balance. You know, we might need to, you know, if we live in the city, go on retreat in the country. And so we might need to do things. We might need to, if we like are at our computer all day, well, yes, going to the art gallery on Sunday is a start, you know. But we're doing it with the aim of not having the ultimate work-life balance, but ultimately seeing beauty everywhere. And I think that we can actively just putting ourselves in sort of surroundings of more beauty can be a good start as well. Yeah, so by sort of actively, we're going into nature, especially going on retreat in nature, by actively, going out of our way to sort of experience the arts and art and poetry or whatever sort of draws you particularly, kind of gives us a head start. You know, ultimately we'll see beauty everywhere, but at the moment we probably don't. And I think it gives us a head start because it does draw us. It's got that sort of, it's got that compelling magnetism. And I think also it's quite interesting that Bhante's saying that the difference between work and play is that play isn't necessary. In a sense, it's the same with it's the same with the arts, isn't it? It's not, the arts aren't necessary. Again, Bhante says no one ever dead from lack of art. He says it's quite superfluous. But again, he says that's why it's so necessary. Yeah. So you wouldn't die without it, in a sense. You wouldn't literally die, but you'd kind of die, wouldn't you? And actually, it's the same with nature as well. I was just reading, I don't know if you've read Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell, but in one section of it says futuristic zone. And everybody's kind of working in this gigantic underground fast food outlet, yeah? And there's no natural light. All they have is the red and yellow of the outlet, and they're just kind of going faster and faster, saying, have a nice day, and serving people burgers, yeah? And they never see nature, ever. But they don't die. You know, they don't die. It's been calculated scientifically in this futuristic world that they won't die. You know, their kind of food's pumped in. I think they get food sort of injected into them, and they only, anyway, you know, it's all set up. So they don't literally, so you wouldn't die without nature, literally. You wouldn't die without art. So in a sense, it is superfluous to literal life, but that is why it's so necessary, because it's not harnessed to a goal. Yeah, it doesn't serve a purpose. This is why it's so necessary. And, you know, Bhatti's he's very much emphasised in Sri Ratna. There's very, very strong emphasis on the arts and a very, very strong emphasis on immersing oneself in beauty. And I think more and more I've come to understand why Bhante's done that. And I think what Bhante's really, really keen to say to us, and even to say as a correction to us, is that enlightenment or insight isn't a sort of bland absence. It isn't a sort of state where everything tastes the same, as it were. Sometimes I get a bit worried that people seem to think that. I must say, even some people in our movement seem to almost describe it like that, a sort of state where there's just an absence of anything and everything's a bit, yeah, everything tastes the same. And Bhante's very, very keen to say, no, no, it's not like that. It's much more of this quivering responsiveness to life. You know, the Buddha also emphasises this. It's not something that Bhante's just said that the Buddha didn't say. The Buddha, he's quoted, somebody says to the Buddha, oh, are you telling us that all life is really ugly? And the Buddha says, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm simply saying that when you reach enlightenment, then you'll know what beauty really is. I think that's rather lovely. And also it gives you a sense of a path of increasing beauty. When you reach enlightenment, then you sort of look back and then you think, oh gosh, I never knew what beauty was then. Now I know what it really is. So you've got this path of increasing beauty. And I think this faculty of responsiveness to beauty is something that we can draw out of ourselves more and more. It's not something that you've either got or you've not got it. Even if you think you've not got it, you can kind of nurture it and cultivate it. My true band was saying, I think you were saying earlier, weren't you, that some people just say they don't like art. Guys, I must confess, I used to be one of those people that think, oh, I got a bit overwhelmed in an art gallery, and I used to think, oh my God, I don't know how I'm supposed to respond, and I don't know what I'm supposed to say. And then I started, it changed when I started going to art galleries with my boyfriend, and he really would be very responsive to visual art. And I just started saying, well, what do you like about this painting? And he said, oh, but do you see how the light source, you know, it looks as if it's come from here? So he just started sort of saying a little bit. And I said, I must have, without knowing it, started to respond to it more. And then at the weekend we were at the Turner exhibition. And I said, oh, come and see the light in this painting. And he said, ah, you know, So, you know, it's something that you can... You know, as I say, it's not something you've got or not got. It's something that we've got glimmers of, but we can become more, we can develop that faculty of responsiveness. And the the easiest way to do it, I think, because it does, as I say, give us a head start, is just notice what you find beautiful and just allow yourself to dwell on that more. And for most of us, that probably, I don't know what all your experiences are, be experiences of nature. You know, like when you suddenly see a rainbow or a sunset, you know, you just want to show people, don't you? Or experiences of art, whether it's, you know, visual art or poetry or music. You know, find what it is for you and really cultivate that. And it's what we're trying to do is cultivate, it's not passive, you know. We're trying to cultivate, I thought Maitreya Banda said that really beautifully about the Titian. It was as if the painting reached out to him, you know. And again, you've got that in the poem about, you know, this little girl, you know, little Frida, Ted Hughes's daughter, she's seeing the moon. You know, there's her wonderment at the moon. In a way, there's him, the poet's wonderment of, like, her first words. These are her first words, moon. But then it's as if the moon itself is in wonder. You know, it's as if the moon's also looking, you know, she's looking at the moon, but it's as if the moon's reaching to her. And I think we can, that's also something, you can't make that happen, but what you can cultivate in this instance is just noticing it and giving space to it when it does happen. So again, and again, I think we can, we probably all had glimpses of that. And I want to sort of give you an example. I've just got a couple of minutes left, but I want to give you an example from my own life that in a way shows that it doesn't need to come from even anything that we might call art. I've talked about this before and written a lot about it in my books, but it was just an experience. I was making a shrine once. Something that we do as Buddhists. We take in turns each and making the shrine in our community. There's 12 of us in the community, so we take a month each making the shrine. So I was making the shrine, and, you know, I was making the shrine. It kind of looked fine. I don't even think of myself as that good at shrines, but I kind of got a cloth, you know, I got a Buddha, I got some flowers. I kind of thought, it's looking okay, you know, it's looking fine, you know, it's passable. It will sort of do as a shrine. And then suddenly I thought, I want to put a bowl of oranges on this shrine. oranges, I don't know. And I got this golden bowl that we happen to have, and I put these oranges in it. And I put them on the shrine, and I stepped back, and it was like the whole shrine changed. So, and it was like the shrine sort of spoke to me and said, oh, I'm done now. And what I noticed was, it wasn't like the shrine looked like it had previously with just the addition of oranges. It just felt like a new thing. You know, it felt like the oranges made the whole thing different. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't just old shrine plus oranges. And it was like it said to me, now I'm done. And so then my job is to sort of notice it and also leave it, you know. And I think that's what we can cultivate. Actually, that's quite important, isn't it? Because you can't make that happen. You can't just go, all right, I'll do that the next time I put oranges on and it'll be brilliant and all that, you know. You can't, but what you can do is, and to notice it, you have to have space, you know. You have to allow yourself just a little bit of quiet. You can't just go, right, okay, shrine done now, cook the dinner. You know, you've got to leave yourself out of that space. So that's what you can have to say. You can listen to it. And again, what you can actively do is the thing. I think Maitreya Banda said this last week, and he said it is, you can cultivate this practice of doing nothing. Yeah, you can cultivate this actively doing nothing, which is different from not doing anything. It's doing nothing. One writer says he puts that in his diary, doing nothing. And then somebody says, oh, are you free on Wednesday? He says, I'm doing nothing. Okay. Oh, so you are free then? He says, no, I'm doing nothing. So that's your homework, is to, I think, I don't know if we gave this homework last week, but we're giving it this week, two homeworks. One is, in the week, to spend some time every day, maybe 10 minutes doing nothing, in your diary, doing nothing. And then also is just maybe at least once in the week of just allowing yourself to experience beauty. So what do you find beautiful? So if it's a piece of music, just listen to the music without doing anything else, yeah? If it's a painting you love, just going and looking at that painting without doing anything else. If it's a poem, if it's a particular tree you love, go and spend time with the tree, you know, without doing anything else, yeah? So do that in the week. These things will teach you more than we can teach. I mean, we can say these words to you, but we can't. It's going to have to be up to you to do this. So that's your homework, and I'm going to leave you with some words of banter, the last words of his lecture on the Greater Mandala. He says, "You don't have to justify your existence by being useful. You yourself are the justification for your existence. Don't be ashamed of sitting around and doing nothing. Glory in it. Do things spontaneously, out of a state of inner satisfaction and achievement. It is a virtue to be ornamental as well as useful." Okay, so see you next week. Thank you.